And I think one of the problems we have is we really don't know how to live with moral disagreements anymore.
Welcome to The Political Animals. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole, and I'm Assistant Director at the Center for Public and Contextual Theology, where I work on the topic of political theology, the intersection of religion and politics. I'm joined in this episode by Reverend Dr. Andrew Errington, and he's joining me for a conversation about vaccine mandates, freedom of conscience, vaccine hesitancy, and sundry issues related to that. I've invited Andrew to come on the show because of a few things about him that make him ideally placed to do this conversation with me. And the first is that he's actually an ethicist. He has a PhD in ethics and he taught ethics. Actually, he was a former colleague of mine. He taught ethics at St. Mark's National Theological Center at Charles Sturt University down in Canberra. But also, he's the rector of an Anglican church, I think in Newtown and Erskineville. Obviously, a church can't be in two suburbs, but I think that's probably where his flock comes from. And that means he has practical experience in terms of trying to navigate government health requirements during lockdowns and about what churches can and can't do. And he's also had to contemplate this issue of vaccine mandates for his own congregation and deal with the pastoral issue of vaccine hesitancy in his own church. And if that weren't enough good reasons to bring him on the show, he's also written on this topic of vaccine mandates, specifically as they pertain to the church. And we will talk about the issue of vaccine mandates in the church, but we also have a wider conversation. So with that very lengthy introduction, Andrew Errington, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jonathan. Long-time listener, first-time caller. It's great to be here. I should just for the record, I mainly taught systematic theology at St. Mark's. I hope I taught a bit of ethics on the side, but my research was in ethics, but I mainly was teaching theology. And our church is in two locations. We have two sites. We're a kind of combined parish with two church buildings, one in Newtown, one in Erskineville. Though since COVID, we've only been meeting in a beautiful big old church, St. Stephen's, Newtown.
Okay. Wow, that's interesting. I had no idea because when we had a conversation about how I was going to introduce you, just as I was skimming through the notes you sent, I just saw the two locations and tried to make sense of that. In any event, I want to start, Andrew, with your article, which was published on the ABC Religion and Ethics website. The title was A Fellowship of the Vaccinated? How churches should and should not respond to the state government's COVID-19 restrictions. There's a couple of subtleties to your argument that we will tease out, but let's begin with what I would call your headline argument. And that can be succinctly conveyed to listeners by this two-line quote of yours, which I pull out from the article. Christians, then, you're right, cannot in principle accept the exclusion from fellowship of the unvaccinated as a class. Can you elaborate on why you make this argument or what the basis is?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Jonathan. So when I wrote the article, it was a lot more of a hot button issue in New South Wales because we didn't know what the public health orders would require of churches, except that it was looking likely that there would be a period of time in which vaccinated people were welcome to meet publicly in person, but unvaccinated people would not be. And what we understood was that that would kick in once New South Wales reached a rate of 70% vaccination. But we didn't know how long that would go on for. Now, as it happens, it's turned out to be a bit of a the particular issue has turned out to be a bit of a fizzle, because the government decided to say that at 80% vaccination rate, churches could be open to anyone. They no longer needed to make a distinction between vaccinated and unvaccinated. That was actually partly the result of advocacy from churches, I think. But the other thing that happened is that the gap between that hitting that 70% threshold and hitting the 80% threshold, it became clear that that would be a very short gap. And as it's happened, it's really only been about 2 weeks. And so as those details kind of rolled out, it became clear that period in which churches were being told that they could reopen in person but only to the vaccinated, that was actually going to be a very short period. And so a whole lot of churches made the decision, and it's the decision my church made as well, that they would wait and just open at 80% because it wasn't much further off, and that would give them the chance to open and not have to exclude anybody on the basis of their vaccination status. But that's kind of dodging a bullet, right? That's just, it's worked out like that. I'm very thankful that it's worked out like that, I have to say. But it's meant in some ways that we were able to avoid some really difficult decisions. My article was written before we knew any of that, and I was trying to kind of sort out the thinking that would be required to make some of these decisions. And I really wanted to say two things. The first thing I wanted to say was that the instinctive objection a lot of Christians felt and that had been expressed in a range of contexts to a restriction only to those who were vaccinated and for churches having to kind of police that in some way, the instinctive objection people felt, I wanted to say that was a good instinct, and I wanted to support that. And that's why that line that you quoted is in there: Christians cannot in principle accept the exclusion from fellowship of the unvaccinated as a class. There's more to say about that. But the second thing I wanted to say was that even though that instinct may be right, actually the practicalities are more complicated. And I went on to argue that, and this is the controversial part of my article, but it's the part some people really thought was important. I went on to argue that said, we might be able to find ways to have a temporary period in which we did tolerate a kind of restriction for safety reasons, and we can go on to talk about those. And that's because, you know, I was imagining a period of some months perhaps in which unvaccinated people were not allowed to be at public gatherings. And I was thinking, okay, how would we think about that? I think it was clear to me that if the government said, right, from now on forever, starting now, unvaccinated people are not welcome, that would have been really problematic for churches. But I thought it was a different issue if what we really probably had to think about was a period of a couple of months, maybe. So
there's a couple of issues that arise just out of what you've said already, and a little bit more framing that we should do, which I should have done at the intro, but I don't have the most organized brain, as long-time listeners such as yourself will probably know. Although we used to catch up for coffee regularly, so you know me long before the podcast. The larger contextual thing we should mention, of course, is that your state, New South Wales, is using vaccine mandates quite widely, as is Victoria. So as I understand it, and I haven't looked into it because I live in the ACT, which offers a really interesting comparison and contrast here, but in New South Wales right now, I don't think you can go shopping if you're unvaccinated or sit in a restaurant or a cafe and have a meal. And of course, as we record this just a day ago, the latest large employer in a number of employers and industries, in this case Woolworths, with I think up to 170,000 employees, has mandated vaccines. And I think a lot of state government employers in New South Wales are mandating vaccines, from police forces to teachers. Just to finish off on that little side ACT note, it's an interesting comparison. And of course, we all know Dan Andrews is going further off the reservation than anyone, but that's kind of to be anticipated. Here's a whole nother story. In the ACT, interestingly, mandates have only been brought in very limited circumstances for aged care workers, for early childhood workers, and also for primary school teachers. I disagree with the primary school teachers, but maybe we'll come out that'll come out later. I'm generally against vaccine mandates, except in some exceptional circumstances. But what's interesting about the ACT is they have not mandated it for any other government-employed sector, any private businesses. And right now, the shops are just opening in Canberra, and you can sit in a cafe, a restaurant, you can go to a shop, and there is no vaccine mandate. No one asks you for your vaccination status. Now, of course, the ACT has already hit 99% first dose, and you probably didn't notice this, Andrew, but it just overtook New South Wales again on double dose, so it'll probably hit 85% today. But the point is, in the vaccine mandate issue is really huge. In a way, it's kind of interesting that the churches have escaped this, given you can't actually, you know, you could go to your church, Andrew, unvaxxed, and then if a couple of people wanted to go and have a coffee in a cafe afterwards, and then maybe do a bit of shopping, presumably that unvaxxed person wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, actually, people in New South Wales, so a couple of quick responses. I mean, the ACT government is not
averse
to putting its foot down. And you know, I remember back, I remember in the first COVID lockdown, I remember there was a moment when the ACT government tried to get everybody to walk the same direction around Lake Burley Griffin. They said clockwise is COVID wise. Do you remember that? So it's not like it's a very libertarian state you've got, you know, situation you've got down there. But I mean, there are more restrictions in New South Wales, but cafes you can go to, but you can't sit down. That's right, if you're unvaccinated. And so you could go and get a takeaway. And that's what we've all been doing for a while now. It is really interesting that churches have been given an exemption. And I think it's actually an important kind of, it's a decision worth taking note of, that the state government in the end listened to the argument that churches ought to be kind of in the category of thing that was regarded almost as an essential service, and so you couldn't have these mandates happening with churches at 80%. And obviously the decisions are being made on the fly, but I regard that as a pretty good decision, and a good kind of moment of advocacy from the church leaders who were doing that. I mean, my own bishop, I think, has been involved in that, but also a very, very kind of sensible decision by the state government. And it's really a matter of kind of recognizing that there's some really really deep objections to churches needing to try and do this. I mean, I had all sorts of worries about the idea of policing a vaccine mandate. You know, it's not like we have a kind of heavily guarded door. You know, normally on the door there's a couple of kind of people who are there basically because they're nice people who want to contribute to church, and you know, they're trained as welcomers to the extent that they know, you know, which piece of paper to give people and to say hello and they're all volunteers. You know, we're grateful for their work. So already getting them to make sure people check in using the QR code, that's been pretty easy, but it's another step. But if we had to take a step up from that and say, oh, and now you actually have to, you know, stop people entering, and if they do enter, come and get us, and the wardens will have to decide whether to call the police and things. I mean, that was a kind of really difficult thing to imagine doing. I mean, maybe we would have found a way to do it, but so I think the decision in New South Wales is very welcome, but you're right. You know, it's there are all sorts of other ways it could have been a bit more difficult.
And this does introduce something I want to get to. I'll introduce it now. Maybe we'll tackle it or just have it there hovering in the conversation, because that argument you just made there that I find compelling about the both the burden but also the I can't think of a good term other than yuckiness, which sounds like something a five-year-old would say, but about having to police the vaccine mandate in the church. But of course, that argument could be applied to a cafe or a shop where, again, they don't have volunteers out the front saying, "G'day, welcome to the church." But they're places where they want to welcome people to come in. And so to force them into sort of a nightclub situation where you've got the bouncer sitting there, or he doesn't sit there, you know, the big bouncer standing there checking people's IDs and making sure they're good looking enough, although maybe that's not what you're supposed to do, or you've got the right shoes or whatever. But before you answer that, I'm just injecting that into the conversation.
Well, no, let me say something to that, because I think there are some hospitality business owners who have felt a deep kind of instinctive reaction to this need to police this. Some people have decided not to open until they can open to everybody. I don't think that's a widespread decision because it's just too expensive. But I think those kinds of instincts are always interesting and worth kind of noticing and having a bit of a look at. And in church life, it's always worth paying attention to those instincts, you know, and those reactions, to kind of inquire about whether underneath them there is a kind of deep theological logic that might be at work. And in this case, you know, my article was really an attempt to try and draw out some of the logic underneath these instincts and to try and pick it apart a bit, because instincts are often a good guide to the fact that there's something there, but they're often not a good guide to the whole story. And you need to, and a whole lot of the work of theological ethics actually is trying to think through and prize open the order of getting to judgments that we might otherwise get to very quickly. And in this case, I think the there is an interesting echo of those kind of basically theological points in all sorts of hospitality industries, you know, and I mean, you could go quite quickly, quite deep into theological territory. You could talk about what hospitality is and what it shows us about human life, but we probably shouldn't go there now.
But you did start heading exactly where I wanted to take us, which is I want to interrogate this against the backdrop of what you and I have just articulated, and that is, you have, perhaps not exclusively, but fundamentally, you have theological arguments to do with ecclesiology, the sort of theological significance of the church, for your argument that it would be unwise, unjust, unchristian, whatever word you want to use, to exclude a class of people. And so I want to hear your articulation of the theological argument. The reason why I introduced the parallel is I'm also interested in whether you think the church is something, if you like, sui generis here. That is, it has its own rationale for not being able to exclude people. I wonder if you think, to what extent you do think that theological logic, to use your term, could be used to mount an argument against vaccine mandates per se?
That is a really interesting question, that second one. I'll have to think a little bit about
Can you think about that as you're articulating the answer to the first one? And maybe that's impossible.
I can try. So the first question is about what's the theological logic? At its deepest, I think that the key point is that at the heart of the Christian gospel is this claim that Jesus Christ has opened access to God for all. and that there is no distinction anymore between kinds of people. There's no hierarchy between kinds of people who are more or less acceptable to God, right? And there's some key statements about that in the New Testament, you know, and one of the key divides for the earliest Christians was between Jew and Gentile, and this was a difficult thing to recognize, but actually they recognized it really quickly, that Gentiles were no longer excluded, and actually they were to be included and welcomed into the Christian community on an equal footing with the Jews. And by the same token, that actually applied to male and female. There could be no hierarchy there anymore of acceptability. There was all were one in Christ Jesus. There was a deep equality. And it even applied to kind of socioeconomic and political categories like slave and free. Slaves, and some of the most extraordinary statements in the New Testament, I think, are about the equality of the slave and the free person. Paul will say every slave is already a free person in the Lord, and every free person is always a slave of Christ. And so there's this kind of deep basic equality of people's participation. And what that means, I think, is that no class of people can be excluded automatically, right? Now, there's more to say about the extent to which whether you're vaccinated or whether you're unvaccinated becomes a kind of class category. And I think, in the way that when you start to make kind of widespread distinctions like this, that really can easily become a kind of identifying category. And if that's the case, you know, the logic of the gospel, I think, ought to make us deeply allergic to excluding a class of people on that basis. Now, my article actually takes some time to say it's not that churches never exclude anybody, right? Churches do have to exclude people sometimes. There are moments of exclusion in the New Testament, and they're always about defending the integrity of the Christian community, if I can put it that way, and particularly protecting the Christian community against kind of assaults on it that are motivated by a kind of sinfulness. So you've got the story of Ananias and Sapphira, for example, in the book of Acts, who their deception represents a kind of fundamental assault on the integrity of the community. So it's not that churches can't ever exclude people, but it's that the logic of the gospel, the logic of the good news of Jesus, always pushes away from excluding a group of people kind of as a class or as a group, because those kinds of and these categories really easily start to look like, you know, categories that have a kind of spiritual valence, you know, clean and unclean, pure and impure. And a real burden of the kind of message of the New Testament is to push back on all of that and say, no, we're all unclean and we're all made clean in Christ. We're all impure and sinful and we're all forgiven and brought near through Christ. There aren't these kind of human distinctions between Jew and Gentile anymore. So that's a kind of deep... that's the kind of central deep theological reason, I think, to say what I said there. Now, your second question about the extent to which that could apply elsewhere.
Just while you're thinking, something did really strike me. I mean, you made, as I heard you outline, if you like, the essential nature of the church. It really is sui generis. That is, there's no other organization, whether it's a business or an institution, that thinks of itself like that. So even an atheist who's just trying to take this phenomenologically would be able to recognize that this community called the church, they really do although I might think their identity is baseless, it really is something very unique, and there is a kind of internal coherence at the very least. I mean, I'm a Christian, so I'm sort of on board with this. I'm just trying to tease it out to relate it to the secular world. There is a kind of internally coherent view of what this community constitutes that really does distinguish it from any other entity I can think of in society. But that doesn't, for me, resolve the question. And I'm being a bit cheeky because I don't necessarily know the answer, and I'm rapidly trying to think while I push you to talk, because the same issue confronts both of them in terms of what you do with what is the just and right thing to do with the unvaxxed.
Yeah, well, let me make a couple of comments. So the first is just to respond to what you said there. I think it's important to say that I'm not making a claim, and I don't think anybody's making a claim, that Christians consistently or universally achieve this goal, right? I think churches are, like most human organizations, often beset by these intractable forms of prejudice, and we keep mucking it up. You know, we keep failing to recognize that the gravity and the radical thing that has happened because of Christ. So we're you know, you go to any old church, and I mean, you may well encounter kind of class prejudice and racism and so on. So the second thing to say is I think the question about whether this logic can be applied elsewhere needs to be answered historically at one level. So there is the presence of the Christian church and the presence of this movement within a society has an effect on it, right? But it has different effects in different times and places. Oliver O'Donovan, who you've done work on, and so have I, and that would be like a whole other podcast episode. We could talk about his work. But he has a great concept he talks about society within the penumbra of the gospel. And penumbra is a great word. I love the word penumbra. I think it's a reference to like the kind of halo that appears around the moon when it's bright, that kind of image. Anyway, the image, I take it, is a way of saying how society kind of gets a kind of reflected light and blessing from the presence of the church within it. So he's trying to give an account of how a wider secular world will be impacted by the presence of the gospel. And I find this a very useful concept for thinking about ideas, a lot of aspects of the history of the West, say, and Christendom, where the presence of a Christian church with a greater or lesser degree of success in expressing its core convictions has had a kind of impact in a whole range of ways. And those impacts are found in all sorts of interesting places. And one of the places I think they might be found is on the practice of hospitality and on the assumptions about welcome we have. I think certainly the presence of assumptions about human equality and dignity in the West are all, in many ways, the gift of Christian faith in our life. And there's others who've argued that, of course, really kind of at length. But I think, you know, you only have to look at what the Stoics and, you know, the various kind of, and the Neoplatonists and things actually thought about human equality to see that Christianity was something pretty radically different. So I think that's kind of the beginnings of where I'd go to answer that the presence of the church has had an impact on these the society around it. But then you've got to extend that historically and say that sometimes then you get a kind of reflex effect where the church forgets some of its central convictions and actually sometimes can get can learn them again from the world that picked them up along the way. But it hears them back in a kind of distorted echo form. That's actually, I think that's part of Charles Taylor's argument. Charles Taylor thinks that the church in modernity needs the kind of presence of the secular society to remind it of some of its core convictions. But I'm not a Taylor expert. So that's where I think I'd start to go. I'll say one more thing, though, which is that this issue of excluding people as a class, right, is only part of the question. You've also got to – the church has also had to struggle from the very first day with differences of opinion, right? And you have evidence even within the New Testament of kind of groups solidifying around different judgments on moral questions. And so that the really most illuminating example, I think, is the issue of whether Christians could eat food sacrificed to idols. And this comes up in the New Testament, particularly in Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And it's really kind of – that's an issue that's really weird and alien to us. But if you just do a little bit of work to get inside it, you can see how it would have created these different judgments that would have – and how it could have created two groups that actually have real trouble getting on. And it's because – whether Christians could eat food sacrificed to idols was a question that, firstly, it's partly about bodily health, right? Anything about eating is about bodily health. It's partly about kind of the logic of purity and impurity, whether you're corrupted by what you eat. And it's partly about the kind of the relationship of the church to the kind of pagan civil society. You know, eating food sacrificed to idols was part of being part of this pagan world. And there were people who'd been converted out of that for whom becoming a Christian meant turning their back on all of that. And so you can see how, I mean, there's analogies to the vaccination issue, but what's important, I think, at this point to say is that the church has always had to struggle with how it copes with people coming to a different moral judgment and groups kind of solidifying around different moral judgments. And that the New Testament gives evidence that that's always been a challenging question for the church.
What I want to do at this point is attempt to reframe the initial question I answered, but I'm going to leave it hanging as a rhetorical question for now because I think – we might try and address that a little further down the road. Famous last words. I always tell myself not to promise things at this point in the podcast because you never know if you'll get to them. But I say that because there's just a couple of further things I want to tease out, both from your article and around this issue of vaccine mandates and churches and the nature of the church, because there are layers of subtlety and complexity to it. I suppose what I was really thinking about, or what I was really trying to drive at, which I think I can now properly articulate, is, and again, I stress this is rhetorical, and you'll have a bite at this later.
Go for it. Yeah.
If, as you have argued, and I think cogently, and I agree with you, why wouldn't I, that churches cannot exclude unvaccinated as a class, and it would be wrong for the government to enforce that, which they did momentarily in New South Wales. One suspects they may do so in Victoria. And not in the ACT so far, but that's a different story. The question I really have in my mind is, and I have my own answer, the answer is yes, but if you're going to make that argument, aren't you then compelled to argue that they are inappropriate in most other settings? Like, why should the church be exceptional here? Why should the state, and why should non-Christian citizens, non-church-going citizens, accept, oh, yes, the church really is this body of Christ and it's something mysterious and magical. And yes, of course, people should be able to go to church. But meanwhile, I can't sit in the cafe. Or even worse, I've got to lose my job as a teacher because I'm not going to take the vaccine. That's where these two tracks unite into one. And I find it an interesting question. But I know it's terrible for me to leave that hanging there. It's like the end of an episode. You know, you end on a cliffhanger so that people come back and watch the second episode. But before that, there is just one final thing I want to get at, because you have alluded to the fact that you think there are exceptions where it is possible to exclude or deny someone from attending a church, particularly if their presence is going to be destructive to unity or perhaps corrupt the orthodoxy of the faith. And I can think of loads of examples which are pertain to an individual rather than a class of people. So I was thinking about this, you know, I could see how, let's say you have a female who's attending your church, she has an apprehended violence order or restraining order against an ex-partner. Ex-partner turns up at church, says, "You can't deny me. This is the body of Christ. I want to participate." I mean, A, that would be breaking the law. And of course, you have some duty of care to your congregant who has the restraining order. Similarly, the very vexed question of a child sex offender who gets out of jail, rocks up to your church for the first day. I mean, probably doesn't have written on their t-shirt "child sex offender," but just for the sake of argument, says, "Look, I'm interested in Christianity. I'm not a Christian yet, but I'm trying to get my life on track." And maybe you have a dozen young children at the church. I mean, that could be pretty disruptive. There is some kind of threat there. But I keep ramming all these things and not letting you chew on them. But I want to read a quote from yours because, so I guess what I'm saying is, okay, granted, we accept that there are grounds for excluding individuals, okay? We could come up with 100 different particular cases. But you actually make an interesting article, notwithstanding your baseline judgment, that it could, in specific circumstances, be warranted to exclude a class of people, albeit temporarily. Just let me read out what you say in relation to this particular aspect of the issue. "The intention of the restriction of public gatherings to those who have been vaccinated is to protect those who are most vulnerable, the unvaccinated themselves, and those whose hospital services they might compete for if they become ill. This is an intention that churches should, it seems to me, support. Churches often must consider issues of safety and sometimes have to place limits around certain people in the interest of safety."
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for all those thoughts. So this gets us to the heart of things. So I think what I want to say is the theological point I made first, right? That is the deep principle we are called to bear witness to. But the churches are called to bear witness to, right? But that doesn't mean it's simple to implement that. And that doesn't mean we escape to some magical kind of fairy kingdom where there's no need to worry about any of the distinctions we're talking about. Actually, the early church still had to worry about the differences in social status of men and women. It had to worry about the differences in habits of Jew and Gentile, and it certainly had to deal with the reality that some people were slaves and some people were free, and it couldn't just snap its fingers and make that go away. And so what I'm arguing for is to keep this principle in mind, but then to do the careful work of thinking about how we bear witness to that in the vexed and complex situation we're in. And this is where I'd want to say I think too many Christians weighing in on and speaking about their instincts about this did not do enough hard work to think about the practicalities, and especially did not do enough hard work to think about the issues of safety. The sex offender example you raise is actually quite an instructive one. So churches, this does happen at churches, and churches tend to have, at least since they've got their act together, especially since the Royal Commission, they've tended to have policies and procedures for this. So the Anglican Church, where I am, has a system for reporting these things and developing what's called a safety plan, which is done in agreement with the person and the church wardens. And what we don't do is just tell the person to get lost, right? Because, and that's because of this deep instinct that and this deep theological conviction that actually the church is a place for recovering sinners. It's not a place for people who always do the right thing. So we don't tell the people to get lost, but we also don't just say, hey, come in, you're welcome, be a Sunday school leader. You know, we say, okay, we want to welcome you because Christ welcomes us all, but this is what it's going to take, and this is how this is going to happen, and these are the conditions under which we can do that with integrity as a community. And sometimes they're quite strict and difficult for these folk. But we do that because we care about safety, and we're trying to take real steps to make sure children are safe within our communities. Well, I think obviously the issue of vaccination is different in a million ways, right? But I think the issue of safety also needs to be considered. And so what the question we've got to ask is, okay, so how do we bear witness to this deep theological principle that somebody should not be cut off from Christ because they come to a different judgment about vaccination, right? How do we hold on to that with both hands, but also take seriously the practical realities we're facing? And here, part of the problem is this: the practical realities are exactly what people disagree about, right? But here, a church leadership actually has no choice but to decide what they think is true, what they're going to go with, how they're going to submit to the ruling authorities, as they're called to do, and make decisions about how they're going to implement this, and holding on to these things. And I've made an argument now to say that there are ways, I think, of bearing witness to the point that people should not be excluded on this basis from Christ and still contemplating a temporary exclusion from people in face-to-face gatherings. Now, you know, how do you do that, you might ask? Well, there are kind of a couple of caveats I put to that. So I came to the view that we could only contemplate excluding this group of people, which in my own church is actually very small, and we could only contemplate excluding this group of people if we were able to continue to offer a really substantial online program at the same time. So we were not fully excluding people. People were still very much part of the thing. They just weren't present in person. And I was thinking about ways in which we could kind of symbolically bear witness to the fact that this was not an ideal situation. And the particular judgment I was thinking about is the judgment of saying, how about we refuse to celebrate the Lord's Supper until we can all be back in person together? And so that was a way of kind of trying to say, look, these practical realities are real. The government has made laws. We have actually, they're not crazy laws, like we have reasons to respect them in many ways, and we're called to do so. And but also we want to keep bearing witness to the fact that this is not how we want to operate. So that's how I think how I'd begin to respond to that. How does that land with you?
Look, I don't have to wrestle with this in any practical way because I run nothing, let alone a church. But it all sounds very, very reasonable to me. And I would just stress so that listeners are aware, because you said it earlier, but I just want to inject that you do note in here that you really stress the temporary nature of the safety consideration, and that, as you said, just to remind listeners, as I said, if this were to be made a sort of permanent restriction, then that would change the ethical consideration for you as a church leader, and you would have to stand against that. So I guess I think, you know, when it comes to ethical decisions, I agree with you that the safety and temporary versus permanent are often left out of the conversation. And so some parts of the Australian Christian community, and I dare say this is even more virulent in the US and in some other countries, some part of their instinctive reaction kind of assumes that none of this is going to be temporary. Neither the safety considerations, that is the threat from the disease, and I don't think that's going to be permanent, or it's going to significantly attenuate. And I think there's a kind of knee-jerk reaction that, you know, we're living. I mean, the term that keeps being banned around is totalitarian and authoritarian, and I think it's a fundamental mistake to make that pronouncement during an emergency situation. If in 5 years' time we're all living under severe restrictions, then hell yeah, authoritarianism. But it seems like a total conceptual misapplication to suddenly throw that out in a temporary situation when it's too premature. There's no ground to think that they will be anything other than temporary if we accept that the threat from the disease will attenuate, which it already is thanks to the vaccination rate.
Well, right there, you see, is where people's really different kind of feelings about the nature of the system we're under inject themselves. And so just to push back on what you said a bit, in the way that I had a very good conversation with somebody who's against vaccine mandates and themselves not vaccinated in my congregation, who just pointed out to me that his line, it's a great line, he said, well, nothing's as permanent as a temporary government restriction, you know, and I think it's actually, so his pushback on the argument I was making and that you're making is, no, this is a really slippery slope, right? This is a really slippery slope. Nothing is as permanent as a temporary restriction. Temporary restrictions are the first step into they're the first incremental step to ending up in a situation which, if you'd gone there straight away, everybody would agree was intolerable. I think that's a really important argument, right? And it's I've taken that really seriously in my own kind of reflection on this. And here's where your different kind of people's different assumptions about government come in. You know, we've both lived in Canberra. You've worked in government. I have family members who work in the public service. Right? My sense of the kind of reality of most of the governments in Australia is that their big problem is not a creeping desire to be totalitarian, but creeping bureaucratic paralyzation and kind of nonsense and just kind of mess, right? It's a very banal kind of evil that's happening, I think, mostly in government. This is another reason I'm totally unpersuaded by conspiracy theories, and you've talked about that in a previous episode. It might not have been an interview. It was just one of the ones where you just lectured us. That was good. But, you know, that's my kind of my sense of government is not a kind of real. I think a whole lot of politicians in Australia are honestly trying to do good. They're trying to bring justice. They're often a bit incompetent and they get things wrong, but some of them are doing the best job they can. And I think in this case, even though I share some concerns about the powers given to, you know, chief health officers and so on, I think they have been trying to do good things, things that in principle we can get behind. But some of the people I talk to have a very different feeling about the nature of government. and especially people who were kind of who grew up in totalitarian regimes in Eastern Europe or whatever, they're allergic to these moves in a way that I'm not. And I think that's all worth taking seriously. So I think the argument that a temporary restriction could balloon in time into a kind of permanent restriction and you might get to the point where you've lost your chance to fight it, you know, I think that's an argument worth taking seriously. But in the end, I don't agree with it in this situation. I came to the judgment that, I think what we should do now is support this with the clear kind of understanding that we didn't really like it and we needed it to be temporary. And if there was any, as soon as we got any hint that this was going to turn into a kind of permanent scenario, we were going to really, really object. Now, that's a judgment call. And it is it's a judgment call that is shaped by your assumptions about government, but it's also shaped by, and I've mentioned this a couple of times, it's also shaped by something I think the New Testament does teach and that still applies in a liberal democracy, which is a basic attitude of willingness to submit to and respect government, even when it's pretty problematic. And people get stuck into that, but I'm just, at this point, I'm pretty bound by what I think Scripture teaches. And I don't think I don't think Scripture teaches that in a foolish way. I think Scripture teaches that our ground level and our starting point ought to be an attitude of goodwill and willingness to go with government. And I think Scripture does that because it expects that to be more useful in the long run. It does that with its eyes open, though, because the New Testament also knows that governments can become totalitarian and can become really wicked in some of the ways they go. So I actually think this is an interesting question, this temporary permanent, and I think that argument that there's nothing as permanent as a temporary restriction is one that, you know, you can't just brush aside.
Look, in my view, it's a cute line and it sounds more plausible than it is, but I don't actually think there's a good historical basis for thinking that. I think history places the onus on the other foot, but let me say a couple of things. First, I just want to be very clear here. I am not saying a shift to some form of authoritarianism is not possible in a country like Australia or America. I think it's possible, full stop. Even if they weren't, if you asked me this before the pandemic, I would have said yes, because that's just my general, one of my philosophical baseline assumptions about human nature and politics. Democracy, I may have even said this on one of the podcasts before, is like a good marriage. It takes a hell of a lot of work. If you stop working, then the malignant and the manipulative can actually come to power and you can quite easily slip into authoritarianism. So I don't rule it out in this specific situation. I simply note that all of the talk of authoritarianism is speculative and making predictions. They assume a state of affairs years down the road, and I would simply say, in my view, there is no evidence for that yet. The evidence may emerge, but in fact, the funny thing is, as people are screaming authoritarianism, restrictions are being eased. You and I live in jurisdictions. We just went through long, brutal lockdowns, and we are now coming out. And yes, of course, we're being returned. We're not gaining freedom. We're just restoring rights that we lost. But
and this is a really, actually, a good, in New South Wales at least, it's a really good example, I think, of how a willingness to be basically cooperative with government on the part of the churches has, in the end, produced a relaxing of the restrictions in a way that's much more tolerable for churches. So I think it's a kind of success story of adopting a posture of goodwill towards government. Now, that won't be the case every time. Historically, it hasn't been the case every time. But in this case, it's instructive at that level, I think.
Mm. let me put to you a bit of a, I don't know if it's a theory. Theory is such a vague, loose term, but I'll just use it in the loosest and vaguest sense. Let me offer you this theory of what's happening. And this is a big macro level theory illustrated by the pandemic.
I don't know if the podcast is the right place for grand speculation, Jonathan.
Well, I am the pontificator in chief of this podcast. So, you know, if you don't like it, you probably stopped listening a long time ago. But the issue is politics is defined by a common set of objective facts, but we don't have full comprehension or access or visibility to those facts. So there are certain facts like the health orders are what they are. You can have 100 different views of what the health orders are. They can even be enforced and implemented and interpreted differently, but they are written down somewhere in black and white. That's just an example of the objective empirical reality I'm talking about. Sometimes it's much more obscure because you've got many variables, different human minds and decision makers and interests, and you can't see every move that's being made. But the key factor is we have very individuated experiences. And so that means that the common set of objective facts really ramify and they branch off, and your own personal experience can give you a totally different perception from someone else. And that communism example was instructive. I've spoken to people who grew up in the Eastern Bloc, and they're clearly traumatized by the experience, and they see communism everywhere. And in places, I just don't see it. Not because, I mean, I'm with them on the moral grounds. I hate communism, and they genuinely suffered. But it's quite clear to me that it colors then, when they move to Western countries, they see communist forces and conspiracies everywhere, which would make perfect sense if you were in Poland or Russia or Bulgaria, but it makes little sense in Australia. This is where the authoritarian, the view that these temporary measures won't be temporary would be highly, highly plausible in China and Iran. Why Australians think that's plausible when these leaders are going to have to face election, and there are parliamentary committees and inquiries, there are free and uncorrupt courts where you can prosecute litigation. But back to my point about experience, you see, I'm a perfect case of this, and I'm very transparent that my experience colors my view of government. I'm very trusting. The moment the vaccine in Canberra became available to 40-year-olds, I just signed up. I was one of the first to get it. I had my second dose of Pfizer. I looked at this back on the 10th of August. I'm still alive. I haven't dropped dead yet. But of course, I worked in four different government institutions for 13 years. My wife has worked in government for 20 years. I've been in Canberra for 24 years. I know dozens and dozens of people that have worked in all kinds of bureaucracies. And so I know immediately that 90% of conspiracy theories are just prima facie implausible, because I know mechanically how government works. I know the kind of people, the kind of systems. It's not that government's perfect. It's just that I immediately think, how on earth could this even be done, and how could it be kept secret? And you realize that their plausibility is correlated with a degree of ignorance about the way government works. Now, that's fine. You can't criticize ignorance, because if you're a farmer out in some rural part of Western Australia, why on earth would you know how the Therapeutic Goods Administration actually does its business? In any event, the fact is that these individual experiences give us a totally different perception of the common unified political reality. Now, what social media does is allow you to connect with other people that have your experience. And that actually bolsters and makes you more confident than you would be if you were the one and only person in a town of 100 who had the crazy view. It gives you a confidence that it provides a false sense of evidence that actually this is really big. So if I am a vaccine skeptic, I can quite easily connect not only with hundreds but thousands of other people who think like me. This wouldn't have been possible 30 years ago. And so then I hear every single instance of an adverse reaction to the vaccine. And so suddenly it sounds very plausible that the larger narrative can't possibly be right. But let me say that I don't live in that universe. I live in Canberra, so literally I do not know a single person in Canberra who's unvaccinated, friends, family, colleagues. And I have made a point of asking or every single one of them about their experience. And it's an even mix between Pfizer and AstraZeneca. Not a single one of them was hospitalized. Some of them had a pretty rough time for about 24 hours. One colleague got close to going to emergency, but she just rode out a rough night of fever and got better the next day. Personally, I had zero side effects from both Pfizer doses. So did my wife. Now, of course, see, the vaccine hesitant who is connected in a social network that is looking for every single piece of evidence, and a lot of it's real, they have a picture of reality that's being built by a kind of self-contained exclusive community that has formed together around a common interest. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that if you're outside of that community, I could build the opposite picture just based on my own anecdotal interactions. And of course, what sorts this out is actually the aggregate data, which we have. And personally, for the record, I think the vaccines are perfectly safe and effective. And of course, you know, what does effective mean? No one has ever said it stops the disease 100% or that you can't die. I don't really want to get into those tedious arguments. I'm trying to make a serious point about politics. That's not actually about COVID per se. It's about a wider thing of how our ability to network and connect with people that share our experience actually further divides us. And this isn't an original thought, but I'm just trying to pin it down to experience. And so what it does is it really fragments and fractures what would otherwise be not a perfect unified view of reality, but a much more cohesive view of reality. So, of course, if you are a vaccine recusant and you decide for whatever reason, and personally, I don't care about the unvaccinated. I don't think they're any threat. This is one reason I'm against mandates. I just think they're unnecessary because it's clear enough people in Australia are going to get vaccinated to suppress the vaccine to the max you can. But if you are a vaccine recusant and you are a school teacher and you're forced to give up your job and you've just done, you know, 1,000 years of lockdown in Melbourne, then of course it looks like you're living in the worst dictatorship on the planet. But of course, you've always got to think, people struggle in political analysis to think beyond the immediate future. And that's partly because thinking long-term is a mug's game. But when I was an intelligence analyst, the best thing about that experience was I was forced to go into the uncomfortable zone of the sort of 5-10 year picture forward. But I mean, do these people seriously think in 10 years' time they will still be unemployed because there's nowhere that's going to employ them with vaccines because we have not learned to live with COVID and Qantas still mandates that their pilots and I forgot whatever the PC term for hostess is these days, flight attendant. And do they still think they won't be able to go sit down and have a coffee with a friend? Now, just to get back to where I began, and I'll finish here, you always have to have an open mind. Anything's possible. And I'm a Democrat in the sense of pro-democracy, not the abysmal party in America, just to lay my political biases on the table. But I'm a vigilant Democrat. That is, I think you can never take democracy for granted. You've got to work hard. So you do have to contemplate these issues. You do have to contemplate the temporary nature. And I was just going to give one example to illustrate why I'm a little skeptical of that line about, you know, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary measure. I mean, we have been in many wars before where the government has taken extraordinary command of the economy. The US in World War II and Vietnam is a great example here. And those extraordinary measures, some of them were permanent, but most of them weren't actually. Now, you take the draft in Vietnam. We had a draft in Australia and America. We don't have a draft anymore. That is the most extraordinary. I mean, you think being locked down is bad. Imagine being sent to Vietnam and being forced to kill and possibly die against your will. You talk about coercion. That only lasted as long as the war. Now, I've got to find some way of bringing you back into this soaring monologue.
I can jump in. So I found all all of what you said there, very interesting. And so I'm very pro-vaccine as well. I know I got the AstraZeneca vaccine early because it was the only one I could access, and I got it even before it was kind of recommended for people my age.
That is very keen.
Well, I actually, it's partly based on having lived in the UK, and all our friends in the UK had got AstraZeneca, and I just thought Australia was, I thought Australia was getting a really wonky view of what COVID was like. And it turned out to be right. You know, we're now experiencing something much more like the rest of the world. I think your points about social media are really interesting. And I think one of the problems we have is we really don't know how to live with moral disagreements anymore. And we are becoming increasingly, we're increasingly losing our competencies in relation to dealing with moral disagreements. And this is actually a place where I'm quite hopeful the church can be helpful, because what happens in churches is you do bump up against people who think differently from you about things, and you see evidence of that right from the time of the New Testament. And I think, you know, Paul's really serious, careful account of this in Romans 14 is just so interesting in the light of the decisions we're facing and in the light of social media, because it talks about kind of groupthink, and it talks about approval, and it talks about allowing people to make their own judgments and to stand before God. And you know, he has these great, like, he says things like, who are you to judge another? It is before his or her own master that he or she stands or falls. And then he says, and they will stand, for the Lord is able to make them stand. And so it's this whole kind of, he engages with a disagreement, but with this really deep respect for others. And he asks the Christians he's writing to see for the deep kind of theological reasons they have for letting other people come to their own judgments about things, and for giving them space to make those judgments, for being patient with difference. Now, those are very alien virtues in our society at the moment, and I think you're right that they have become more alien because of the way social media works. It exacerbates the kind of self-reinforcing groupthink. I mean, so your experience of not knowing anybody who's unvaccinated, you know, that's quite a weird experience, I think, and probably not weird in Canberra, but around here, you know, as a minister, I've talked to a number of people who are not yet vaccinated. None of them are crazy, right? Actually, all of them are, if you have the patience to kind of talk to them and take them seriously, they all have reasons for the judgment they've come to at this point. Now, I don't agree with their reasons, right? I came to a different judgment, but I can respect them. And if I listen to them, I actually understand them, and I can see how they've gotten there. I don't think they're right, but I can respect them. And I think we have to be able to do that. And one of the problems with vaccine mandates is it just makes that much more difficult to do. It hardens people in their decision. It makes them even more resistant, or at least sometimes. I think probably sometimes it will push people to getting vaccinated. But I think for some people it makes them even more resistant in just the ways you've talked about, and even less able to talk to somebody else. And I think what churches aim to do is to be able to be patient with disagreement and to allow people to make their own judgments and to continue being together, even in the midst of those differences, so that over time people are actually able to change their minds. But will everybody change their minds? Probably not. We might have to just keep going on being patient forever. And one of the things I think this – one of the reasons for the thought I had about the Lord's Supper, right, is that if you say, okay, well, if we can't come back together – if we can't all come back together, then we're going to, those of us who can, are going to choose to take on a form of suffering. We're going to choose to take on a lack of something out of a sense, out of solidarity with others. If you do that, it sends a really powerful signal that this matters to you and you're willing to be patient through this. I mean, I agree with the things you said about democracy at the end as well, but I think democracy is the democratic culture that has made those things possible will be made easier if people keep learning to tolerate disagreement. One of my teachers, Andrew Cameron, like to talk about churches as schools of moral formation. And I think one of the really important ways in which we're called to kind of be formed morally as to be communities that can tolerate differences over kind of controversial issues.
It occurs to me, this is just one little occurring thought before I move on to a more substantive point I want to make. That the one thing that worries me about the therapeutic totalitarianism crowd, and I have friends in this camp, but I seek out people who think differently from me because they make much better friends in my experience. But setting that aside, is that once you get into that mindset, I worry that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because what you end up doing is propagating mistrust in government institutions, and you start supporting civil disobedience. And so actually, in a perverse way, even though this is not the intention, you may end up undermining the kind of things that make democracy functional in the long term. So I just throw that out as a provocative thought. I just want to say, I want to offer a view, Andrew, because I suspect there might be a difference here between us, perhaps too subtle to be of any interest, but just hearing the way you talk about having a sort of period of patience to work with the unvaccinated. You see, my view is this. Like all my views, it'll probably annoy every side of the debate. Tend to be a bit of an idiosyncratic thinker, for good or ill. I think there is no good reason to be unvaccinated. That is, although all the people I know in Canberra, and I stress it's in Canberra, it's not that I don't know unvaccinated people. I'm exposed. I've read a lot of the arguments online from the vaccine hesitant, because I find it fascinating, but I find the arguments so easy to demolish. Now, I say demolish. It's not that my arguments are so good it would persuade anyone, and I don't bother trying to persuade anyone. And this is the funny thing. Although I think there are no good reasons to be vaccinated, and I don't say that dismissively or lightly. I've spent a lot of time trying to follow their arguments and taking them seriously. I've had some debates on Twitter myself. Not by saying that, I could not care less. I think freedom of conscience means people need to be committed to views that are wrong. That's a fundamental, like, freedom of conscience can't have a one-to-one correlation with truth, because that then ultimately means you do need an authoritarian empire who first determines what is true, and then you simply make sure people's consciences align with the truth. I don't care what people believe. There are people believe 9/11 was done by George Bush and the CIA, or Mossad. People believe the moon landing wasn't real. my wife worked with someone who ended up losing a job in the police force because he believed in the lizard people conspiracy, that lizard people were running the... I mean, quite frankly, I think people have to be free to believe anything that doesn't lead to violence or a severe infringement on people's individual liberties. So I feel no need to persuade anyone that's unvaccinated. Like, I can't stress this enough. I would sit down and have a coffee with someone who's unvaccinated right now. It just wouldn't bother me in the slightest. It's partly a sort of a functional thing that I feel like I'm protected. I believe the vaccine's highly efficacious. It's not a guarantee. That person could ultimately kill me, but I'm willing to take that risk because so I tend to be a little better than average, not the best in the world, but a little better than average at assessing risks, because that's effectively what I was doing as an intelligence analyst and looking at risks at a kind of geostrategic level with a lot of variables. This is why I find myself in a strange position. There are others too, where I am as pro-vaccine as you could get, but also as anti-mandate. Well, not as anti-mandate, because I think there are a couple of exceptions where we do know, we have very solid evidence that the mortality rate is such that I think the common good is imperiled by unvaccinated workers, such as in aged care or ICU units or those dealing with chemotherapy and with certain populations where we know the virus can be very, very deadly. And I think it's fair to do, I think a compelling argument can be made. But right now in the ACT, it's recently been mandated for primary school teachers. And I think that is unjust because I think the risk of both infection and communication of the disease age 5 to 12, and the argument, of course, is that you can't get vaccinated if you're under 12, in a jurisdiction where only a handful of teachers won't be vaccinated, and quite frankly, that's their risk.
So I think I agree with a lot of what you're saying, although I do think I'm probably less activated by the issue of mandates than you are. So, but I agree with you about vaccines. I mean, I don't think there are any good reasons not to be vaccinated, right? And I have heard quite a few of them, but I also I don't care very much about that question, and I'm mindful of my own. So one of the real problems with this issue, right, is not just that people disagree about the medical facts, for example, which they do, right? People dispute the ways in which the data are judged and so on and so forth. But the issue underlying that, which makes this much more complicated, is that people disagree about the moral evaluation of those facts, and they disagree about the weight those questions ought to have. Right. So one of the things I'm aware of for myself is that I actually just don't care much about vaccines and even about, to a certain extent, about bodily health, right? But there's a kind of difference of, I mean, I try and keep healthy, but I don't, you know, the way in which people talk about vaccines and the health of the body and their, it is very alien to me in some respects. I mean, I've been injected with a lot of things in my life, you know, because Australia is very into vaccination, and I've travelled to some countries that required a heck of a lot of other vaccinations. So I kind of have just, I'm just not, I don't worry very much about it. And I'm conscious that I'm not saying that that is virtuous, right? I'm saying it's different from, and I'm conscious of that difference for a lot of people. But I do agree that in this case, my evaluation is the same as yours, that there aren't good reasons not to be vaccinated. I think, though, I'm a bit more sanguine about vaccine mandates, right? Because I think freedom of conscience does not mean people have to be protected from there being any consequences for their own decisions. right? It means people have to be given the freedom to come to their own judgments about things, and we have to respect that freedom in important ways. But it doesn't mean we have to say there should never be any consequences for people coming to different views on things. And I happen to think that if somebody believes in the lizard conspiracy, the lizard Illuminati, right, which underneath is actually a deeply anti-Semitic conspiracy, I don't think they should be a police officer. Mm-hmm. I think that's a view I can. You know, I think we should be a society in which people have the freedom to kind of make mistakes, but I do think mistakes have consequences. And so how you respect freedom of conscience is actually quite tricky. And I think government just has to make decisions all the time about what consequences of people's views are going to be. You know, we accept all sorts of impositions from government all the time, right?
Not just government, Andrew, companies as well.
Yeah, so one of the Christian contributions to this issue ultimately has to be about the nature of freedom, right? The New Testament has a lot to say about freedom, but most of it looks almost nothing like the way we talk about freedom. We talk about freedom as freedoms, freedom from restriction, freedom from imposition. The New Testament talks constantly about freedom as a freedom that can reside even within the most constrained situations, even within a situation, for example, of household slavery in the ancient world. There is a kind of freedom that matters more than anything else. And we ought not, I think, freedoms, they do matter, right? But we've got more important things to say about freedom. And even the person who is compelled to be vaccinated can still do it freely in an important sense, because they still have the freedom to accept that compulsion with cheerfulness and for it not to dominate their lives in resentfulness, right? That is a kind of, now people will kind of laugh at that and say that's not important, but actually I think that's critically important. That is the freedom that matters most, because those freedoms, the freedom of the slave to, I'm talking about ancient world slavery here, I don't mean to be kind of making any particular current judgment, right? But in the domestic slave in, you know, Corinth still has a freedom about how they relate to their good or bad master. They still have a degree of freedom about the way they comport themselves and the way they respond to their situation. And a lot of politics today says that doesn't matter, who cares about that? I actually think those things really deeply do matter, and they remain important. It's not that I don't care about freedoms. I do, right? And I think when you take seriously this New Testament idea of freedom, it leads you to want people to be free in all sorts of other ways. But I think a key kind of part of Christian discipleship for me is a willingness, is understanding and living within the freedom I have, even within a very constrained situation sometimes. And so I think I'm not as allergic to vaccine mandates. I think governments compel people to do things all the time. And, you know, I don't think on the whole these are good public policy decisions. I kind of wish they wouldn't happen, but I think they might happen. And I think, but Christians can still live with them. Yeah.
Let me complicate my own position with the express view of trying to infuriate as many people as possible. I do, and I just preface it by, I really like your observation about the variability of moral weight, and you do have to respect that. So if being forced to take a vaccine is one of the worst things that could be done to you, and that I find that highly plausible, then it is a kind of travesty that can be hard to comprehend, even for someone who's against it, but it's not a life or death issue, and they will relent grudgingly, but sort of move on with their lives. So I'm even open to the idea that this can produce real trauma for people, not to mention, of course, the real world consequence of losing your job. I actually agree with you on a couple of points, which allow me to add further clarity, if that is not used ironically in this context, about my position on vaccine mandates, because I actually think governments have the authority to do anything that is legal. Now, I think the governments, every measure taken, from the strictest lockdown measures, are lawful. Now, that's a simple truism and statement of fact, but I mean it's legitimate in the sense that if you accept the legitimacy of the legislative process in a democracy, then governments can legitimately implement bad laws or unwise laws. So do I like the way the laws are being used? Not in every respect. I mean, I'm not totally against lockdowns, but there's a difference between legitimacy and the soundness of the decisions made. Now, when it comes to vaccine mandates, I even think companies have the right, employers have the right, as they do in a whole range of issues, to mandate vaccines. I just think it's unnecessary and unjust. That is, I think it's an unsound use of the legitimate freedom and authority that accrues to both governments and employers. This is a distinction I find very few people make in politics. The sort of difference between legitimate authority, which gives you a certain scope to do things, and then the merits of individual decisions. That is, the merits or the moral soundness of the exercise of the legitimate authority. I think that they are two separate but related things. And so I do think there are consequences. And again, part of me, and I'm just being utterly transparent, that's my whole thing, honest conversations, including by honest views expressed by the host of the show, that I think because I do think the vaccines are safe and effective, and that there are no good grounds except for that very small group of people who do have legitimate medical grounds and have medical advice that says they shouldn't get the vaccine, separate those. They're in a unique category. Because of that view, I think you have to suffer the consequences. If your employer wants to mandate the vaccine, then that is a consequence of your choice. I stress, I don't like that decision by the employer, not the least because I think it's unnecessary. And I think the necessity thing here is lost. I don't think that is given due consideration by the pro-mandate crowd. There's also proportionality. And just to really elucidate what I'm trying to say there is I will be all in favor of vaccine mandates in the situation or the context of a pandemic with a very different profile. That is, if this were killing 10% of people that got it and we had a vaccine, I'd be much more open to widespread mandates, because then, and I know this is a bit of a consequentialist argument, but I just think you have to take into account the particularity of the emergency situation. In the situation of a war, I'd be quite happy with various mandates and extraordinary government measures if the very livelihood and sovereignty of our nation was at stake. And to your, I sort of got this idea of proportionality from you. It's probably the wrong moral language. It's not my area of expertise. But I do think even you can be discriminating and discerning based on industry. So clearly, there's a big difference between working in an emergency department where you are going to have contact with vulnerable people. And we shouldn't forget people in ICU wards have worn masks forever, like because there's a risk of infection and other things, versus someone that, say, works at a bespoke consultancy with 12 people just working in an office. Actually, consultancy probably the wrong one because you'd have contact with people. But let's say a very small call center where the only contact they have is with the people in the workplace. You know, could that survive with one or two unvaccinated people? I think the argument for mandate is stronger and weaker depending on the type of industry, but also the risk profile of the vaccine. So that probably resolves and achieves nothing except to complicate matters.
Well, no, I think one of the things your comment there does for me is it reminds me that it's very important to be kind of fine-grained when we talk about the specific judgments that are being made. And in particular, I think it's very important to be careful with the language of compulsion, right? So there is all the difference in the world, in my view, between a government saying public school teachers must be vaccinated if they want to continue working there, and a government saying we are going to forcibly vaccinate you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Right? They're wildly different things because now, but the language of compulsion really easily covers both. But actually, it's a big difference for somebody to forcibly vaccinate you is a kind of invasion of the integrity of the body in a way that is extremely troubling.
And you know what it's akin to, Andrew? It's akin to rape, actually.
A violation
of the bodily integrity in quite a consequential manner.
I think that's right. But the government's this government is not going to do that, right? I'm not saying no government would ever do that. They're a wicked.
Well, it's never even been on the table. No government official I'm aware of in Australia has.
Nobody's going anywhere near that because the actual interpersonal realities of doing something like that are so extremely traumatic that it's off the table in almost all situations. And it's important to recognize that's not the same kind of thing as saying, well, if you want to continue working here in a public-facing capacity, then you have to get vaccinated. That seems to me to be a much more reasonable view. But I do think in the situation we're in, there is an opportunity to kind of bear witness to a fundamental conviction about Christianity and to kind of be patient with difference. And when I say be patient, I don't mean be patient for 1 month and then not be patient anymore. I mean enter into a long process of discussion where we are willing to actually hear from one another and where you're even willing to change your own mind about things. That's the kind of discussion. And I don't see people having that kind of discussion very much. You know, not a lot of people I talk to are actually willing to talk to an anti-vax person and maybe come out the other end of the conversation more hesitant. You know, there's a kind of deep refusal to do that. Well, I think Christians are called to, I haven't changed my mind so far, right? But we're called to respect other people and to be patient with difference in a kind of way that's substantial and serious. So anyway, I may have been off track there, yeah.
Yeah, one of the good things about the church or potential good things, I do think it, notwithstanding all its warts, it does achieve this often, is it is a counterweight to the self-segregating online networks of people that reinforce their own view and close the mind to others. Because your average church, even still today, I see this in my own church, is an unusually broad cross-section of society in a world that is more and more fragmented into sort of coalescing experiential groups. And I've often remarked to my wife when we go to church, and I go to a bit of an old fuddy-duddy Anglican church, but it's kind of nice to be in a church where you have lots of different races and you have people aged 0 to 98 and you have professionals, you have bums, you have like every walk of life there. It's so rare now, except maybe places like a football match, which aren't really communities. Or maybe when you go to a cinema, you have that. But it's a very superficial cross-section because you can go there and not interact with anyone but the person you go with. Whereas this is a sort of real community in the sense that you go regularly or semi-regularly, and you end up interacting with people well outside your normal social circle. And if anything, I can see, having had this conversation with you, Andrew, actually, this is a new insight for me, that this feature of the church is going to become more and more important as we interact less and less and more infrequently with those people who do have a different view from us. Because I dare say in most churches, you're going to find someone, at least someone, who is vax hesitant. And you'll find a dissenter on any number of issues, and that forces you to do what I think is healthy, which is to interact and learn to respect people with whom you disagree.
Well, and if I can just jump in there, one of the reasons I care about this is because I think a whole lot of the people who are vaccine hesitant are not kind of very conspiracy theory, full on, you know, QAnon types. Actually, a whole lot of them are people who just, some of them, at least in my congregation, are people who just struggle with life a little bit, you know, and maybe there's mental health issues, maybe they're quite poor and don't have good access to the internet. And I just think we're not seeing, I worry we won't see some of the unintended consequences of restrictions. And one of them may well be that we end up accidentally excluding people just because they're not really succeeding at life in some ways, and they're struggling a bit. And they are precisely, I really don't want to exclude those people from church. It's a principle worth defending in my view, even if I've argued for vaccines in a whole range of ways. So.
Andrew, that's as good a note to end as any, because this is one of those, it's like that Russian doll that you keep, you lift it off and there's another one and you never reach the bottom, although you do with that very poorly chosen analogy. The point is, we were never going to reach the depths of this conversation, but it is so fascinatingly complex on a whole range of issues, and we've managed to incorporate a bit of ecclesiology with some political theory, with some ethics, not just Christian, but Christian ethics, but also wider ethical questions in society. If you like what you heard here in this conversation and you want to support the show, you can like, subscribe. I'm on social media. And if you are an Apple user or listener, please consider giving the show a 5-star rating. Andrew Arrington, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I have missed our catch-ups for coffee, and I didn't realize it would take a podcast to have our next chat, but it's been a real pleasure to workshop this with you.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. I am no Wayne Hudson, but it's been great to be on.
A beloved mutual friend of ours. Catch you next time.
See you.